The Infrastructure Strategies Committee will come to order. Missy, will you please call the roll?
Chair Payne.
Here.
Vice Chair Garrison.
Here.
Committee Whip Smith. Ranking Member Hunchowski.
Here.
Representative Andrade.
Here.
Representative Botana.
Here.
Representative Brackett.
Here.
Representative Buchanan.
Here.
Representative Cassell.
Here.
Representative Cheney.
Here.
Representative Escamani.
Here.
Representative Fabricio. Representative Gottlieb.
Fabricio is here.
Representative Killebrew.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Lopez.
Here.
Representative McFarland.
Here.
Representative Mooney.
Here.
Representative Nixon is excused. Representative Placencia.
Here.
Representative Robinson.
Here.
Representative Shoaf.
Here.
Representative Stevenson.
Here.
Representative Tomko. Representative Trunell.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Great, thank you, Missy. Members, we have a quorum, and housekeeping-wise, please make sure your electronic devices are turned off. You know, staff, we have a great staff. I think most of you have met our staff. If you haven't, please take a time to come by then and see them. And so, members, I just want to start out by saying that certainly I'm honored to chair this committee. I think we have a stellar committee here and a great opportunity to do many good things. As most of you heard last week, Speaker Renters recognized the House Committee structure and created the new Infrastructure Strategies Committee. And we have great chairs of each of those subcommittees. But the importance of being proactive when it comes to addressing Florida's long-term infrastructure needs. With this committee, the speakers created three subcommittees. As you know, you may have heard last week, one focused on Florida water resources, one on conservation, and one on resiliency and transportation. And the speaker grouped these committees together, thoughtfully to make sure we are evaluating the infrastructure planning and natural resources, and that we can protect those as a whole and not piecemeal, not necessarily just fragment those. And I think we've heard some committee discussions in the last few days where we find some reassurance that our agencies are really, really on top of many of these issues. But the whole purpose is really to educate our members. So those long-term solutions, those strategic development ideas for water and water quality and land and transportation resiliency, we're doing those to make sure we assure and maintain the beauty of Florida as we know it, and that we maintain our habitats and we continue to look to areas for a good business climate. Of course, with good business climate, as we heard last week, we have challenges. And so part of what we'll hear today and part of what we'll continue to educate members on are those issues that we see, not only that we have issues with now, but are forthcoming, that our job should be looking at the horizon to make sure we're envisioning what we should be like and what we should be doing to make sure we're protecting Florida and its natural resources. On today's agenda, we'll start the conversation with an economic analysis of the needs of our state related to conservation lands, water resources, water quality, quantity, stormwater, wastewater facilities, and flooding resiliency. And so on the agenda today, we're pleased to have Mrs. Amy Baker here with the Office of Economic and Demographic Research, and she will be providing an overview of EDR's annual assessment of Florida's water resources and conservation lands. Mrs. Baker, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. We, about 5 years ago, EDR started down this path with doing different assessments. So we were charged first with conservation lands and the water resources. We've added to it over the last couple years, and we picked up Everglades, stormwater, wastewater, and flooding resiliencies as different things we're doing assessments on. So our role is not to be the scientist. We're not the folks on the ground that are actually putting up many of the plans together, but our role is to take all of these plans and synthesize them. So basically we have the ability to either run different scenarios for the state, but more importantly to cost out what is needed to make the investments suggested by this multitude of plans. And depending on the topic area, there can be anywhere from about 8 to about 15 plans involved in us pulling the information together and trying to put cost to it. I will start you off by saying that we've broken this into segments. So we have 5 segments. Each one is going to be geared around one topic. We've got a lot of detail in the reports on our website, but this is the highlights of those reports that are coming out now, and they're mostly focused on costs. I would dare say this is probably the most expensive meeting you're ever going to sit through in the Florida legislature by the time we go through it. So the first thing we're going to talk about is Florida's conservation land. And the first thing to know about it is of our conservation lands in the state, about 97% of it is owned by the public. It's either state government, the federal government, or local government. Only about 3.1% is private ownership, but that, even though it's a very small percentage, it's been growing pretty rapidly. So in terms of total acreage owned by all of those entities, we have about 34 million acres in the state of Florida. Of that, about 10.7 million is actually dedicated to conservation. And if you turn that into the state's, a share of the state's acreage, it's about 31.22% that's now we would deem to be officially conservation land. And the map shows you in green where those areas are right now. So one of the things our statute requires us to do is to look at the tax impact associated with conservation land. So any property owned by government, even though it has a just value on the property tax rolls, it has no taxable value whatsoever. So we're able to use our property tax rolls to query how much of the state's tax base is lost by having all of that conservation land. So first thing we would note is that of all the land that has been designated for conservation purposes, eight counties are already in a situation where over 50% of that county is deemed to be conservation land. So that's Broward, Collier, Miami-Dade, Monroe, Okaloosa, Franklin, Liberty, and McCullough. For some of these counties, but not all of them, that's a very significant tax impact. So looking overall across the entire state, about 1.74% of the statewide county tax base and about 1.48% of the statewide school tax base have been removed from the tax roll as conservation land. And so that turns into tax dollars of about $335 million in county taxes and $260 million in school taxes scattered throughout the state. I would also mention to show kind of the dichotomy that comes from this. For five counties and their five rural counties, Dixie, Glades, Hendry, Liberty, and McCullough, the implied share of the tax base that is lost due to the presence of conservation lands was greater than 20%. But among particularly our bigger counties, 12 counties, Broward, Flagler, Lee, Manatee, Miami-Dade, Orange, Pasco, Pinellas, Polk, Seminole, Sumter, and Union, the implied tax base, because it's their property rich, is less than 1%. So a big focus of what you'll be considering and that we're talking about in all of our segments today is what about the future? Where are we anticipating heading? So in this area, we have a number of different plans by state agencies and also by the water management districts that allow us to identify those conservation lands that they would like to purchase in the future, so potential conservation lands. If we were to buy all of them, it would raise the state share from that 31.2% to over 43%. So that's the amount outstanding out there. And that's just looking at the state's programs. If we were to include federal, local, and private plans, it would be an even higher share. So it turns out when we are able to work with all those detailed plans, we geocode the information, and we're able to figure out how much the just value is for those vacant properties today. So when we do that analysis, it's about 4.1 million acres that state agencies and water management districts would like to acquire that they've identified on a plan. And the total projected cost right now is $48 billion. So that breaks down into a cost share where the state share, because we're about 86% of the cost of conservation lands throughout the state. So our state share of that $48 billion is about $41.3 billion. And then there's a federal, regional, and local share. But in terms of the pace of what's happening with conservation land, it's very much governed by the decisions the state of Florida makes, in particularly in conjunction with its water management districts. So this shows you, I won't go through it in detail, but it gives you a chart of what our actual expenditures have been over the most recent period of time and provides a forecast going forward if we kept up that same expenditure pace. So this isn't appropriations, this is actually what's spent in each year. And there is, just to warn you up front, there's a long lag between making the appropriation and when the parcel is actually acquired as conservation land. So it takes a number of years to work through that process. But we've been spending, if you look in fiscal year 21-22, which was the last year we had expenditure data on, we had acquisitions of only $20 million, which was kind of a low point, and if you look back over the history prior to it, about $229.7 million that was actually spent on conservation land management. And that ratio stays pretty good. We're usually about 75% land management expenditures, 25% acquisition expenditures. So it's as a rule of thumb, that works pretty well. If we were to acquire all of the 4.1 million in acreage for future conservation, those areas in gold, we would have to spend, at the pace we're going now, about another $166.2 million. But if we maintain the pace of acquisitions that we've been undergoing over the last 5 to 10 years, it would take us 746 years to come up with the amount of money needed of our share of the $48 billion. So, which is to tell you that the pace is very slow if the desire of the legislature is to acquire all the lands on these lists. So that would be an issue there, which leads you to the final slide in this segment, the time sensitivity of acquisition decisions. So we've been undertaking various studies, and one in particular this year that we undertook provides at least some evidence that future conservation purchases could conflict with or contend with the path of Florida's economic growth, in that both uses are trying to get the same parcels of land. So whichever one gets there first is more likely to have the use that it's put to. We did an analysis of commercial buffers within, or commercial properties within a 2-mile buffer of our future conservation purchases from the list. And what we found is that the expansion of commercial growth close to these conservation lands suggests that the land is particularly attractive to commercial expansion. They were either recently constructed or renovated. So there's a lot of activity going on around these conservation lands. So that has implications for the ability to make the acquisition if we have a very long, drawn-out process, and the price, which continues to increase. We particularly noticed that this year. So basically, it's an economic rule. Increased demand is going to increase the price. And the land that we're looking at this year is already priced, a wide variation, but already priced over $11,000 an acre. So you would expect over time that would continue to drive up just because of scarcity, if no other reason. So that finishes that segment. We're going to turn now to what we call water demand and supply, but you can think of this as water quantity in the state of Florida. So our assessment here is twofold. We do one part of our analysis where we solely work with water management district data and try to convert that into analysis or projection statewide. We have another part of our analysis where we're building an independent model where we're hopeful that we'll be able to do a lot more scenarios and a lot more work with it than we're able to with the water management district data today. But the main horizon that they're using for their planning purposes right now is between 2020 and 2040. So we've adopted that convention. And if you look ahead, water use is projected to grow about 14% between now and 2040. And the graph shows you kind of its relative movements over five-year increments. Most of the increased demand for water as we move forward from now to 2040 is what we refer to as development water use, but you could probably just think of that as your public water supply, that the water supply or utility that's supplying water to household and community. And that may include businesses, commercial, industrial uses too. So that accounts for most of our total growth. Surprisingly, agriculture water use is growing, but just very small relative to what's happening with our population. It's only by about 1.62%. So the next thing I would say is that we're going to talk about what we refer to as an inferred water supply shortage. This is not a shortage like we don't know what to do. This is a shortage of is there sufficient capability to identify supplies, extract them, use them between now and 2040, and what is that gap for the gap from where we are today to where we want to be in 2040? So overall, we do have the ability to address these gaps, but we look at it in a couple different breakouts. So the first we look at is what's the inferred water supply shortage from where we are today to where we want to be in 2040. And the number that we have identified is 373 million gallons per day. So that is the gap we're attempting to close between now and 2040. So the first thing we looked at is there's a number of projects that are already in construction, they're in design, or they're on temporary hold, and what do they tell us about those sources of supply that are already in the works, that are already occurring? And so based on that, we have about 160.8 million gallons per day that we can account for being addressed through these different types of projects. So that leaves a remaining inferred supply shortage of 254.2 million gallons per day. So that's the piece we have to do more work on to get a number for. So to cover this, we've looked at a number of different projects. We put cost to the types of projects. We do it by region. We identify what's most likely to be the projects that are going to come on first, and we come up with an estimate per each region. And it's unique to those regions that we've identified on the left. So by 2040, the total expenditures needed to address the water supply shortage, both what's in the works and what still needs to happen, ranges between $1.37 billion and $2.71 billion, with an average of just over $2 billion. So the question is, do we have enough will we have enough water by the time we get to 2040? The answer is yes. But with the caveat that we're going to have expenditures over that period, and some of this is front-loaded, of about $2 billion to produce it. So there, but that's not all of it. That's the water supply that's associated with human activity or human properties. But there's another issue to water supply, which is the state share needed to, well, let me do this piece first. So if we stick with the $2 billion that I just showed you, if we said, okay, how much of this comes from the state of Florida versus some other entity in terms of picking up the cost, our state of Florida share of this is somewhere between $229 million and $536 million, or an average, which is what we use, of $382.8 million. That's our state share of the $2 billion. And that assumes the state's level of participation in water supply stays about the same. But there, this is the other piece you have to bring into the discussion, which is our law requires us, both EDRs and DEP, water management districts, to think about the natural systems in Florida. So how much of our supply will we have to dedicate or work on in order to ensure that the sufficient water is available to support all of our natural systems is the question. So we use a number of different recovery and prevention strategies. We look at the minimum flows and the minimum water levels by very discrete segments to identify what that need is. And based on all of that information, we think that you need about another $885 million to address the natural systems needs in Florida. Of that, about $132 million would be the state share of that cost, or about just under 15%. So if I'm bringing both of those pieces together, both our inferred shortage and an additional water need for the natural systems initiatives in Florida, it comes up with this table. So overall, just over $2.9 billion is needed. The state share of that would be $514.8 million, or about 17.6% if we kept the same funding arrangements we've had in the past. Now, our independent model, we're still using this as our preferred numbers, our working numbers, but we also have a separate independent pilot model. It suggests a slightly lower cost, overall about $2.25 billion, but the difference is really coming from two places. One is that we end up assuming a greater conservation effort than the water management districts do in their plans, and more discreetly identify it. And also, importantly, their Department of Agriculture's most recent agricultural-based model, which they call FZ9, is also projecting a lower need for agriculture than what you see summing up from the water management districts. And that has to do with their analysis of best management practices going forward and what the participation rate is in those. So our working number for this report is still the $2.9 billion and with $515 million of it coming from the state of Florida. But there is ways to bring that cost down slightly. So we're going to move into our next segment, which is water quality. So our water quality framework in Florida is very, very granular. When you use something called water body identification numbers, or WBIDs, and each WBID is assessed and used in DEP's work for a number of responsibilities, including the impaired water assessment, the total maximum daily loads, the TMDLs, and basin management action plans. Currently, we can identify about 6,700 WBIDs in Florida that are being in various stages of being assessed and analyzed. So the tool that that leads to is total maximum daily loads. This it comes out of Florida's response to the Federal Clean Water Act. As we implemented in Florida, we used the development and implementation of these total maximum daily loads for water bodies or water body segments that do not meet water quality standards, and they're very specified. And so it's a we refer to it as a water quality restoration goals, and it represents the maximum amount of a specific pollutant that a water body or water body segment can assimilate while still meeting water quality standards. So through December 31st, 2022, Florida had 459 TMDLs in place. So typically, prior to recent history, if you had a TMDL in place, it led in one shape or form or another to the development of a basin management action plan. And so they're not one for one. Just because you have a TMDL, it doesn't mean that you have to have a basin management action plan. So the first thing you do, we look at the 1,846 water body parameter combinations in Florida that are listed as impaired and could require a TMDL, but one TMDL can represent multiple nutrient issues. So we calculate at EDR that 1,428 TMDLs could proceed through the development stage into to come about into the future. And so based on that information, we costed out how much it would be a cost burden to the state to proceed to the development stage for each of those TMDLs, the 1,428. And so that cost us about $319 million to proceed to that stage for impaired water bodies in Florida. So that's just to develop them. So once they're developed and put into place, then you look at the basin management action plans. So since 2005, that's been in law our primary response to the existence of a TMDL or an impaired water body in Florida. And so right at this moment, we have about 33 basin management action plans in place. These are sometimes referred to as the BMAPs. So of those 33, obviously, there's a big gap between that number that's in place today and shown in the green on the map and the potential that we were just looking at of 1,428 TMDLs. So if you are to assume that each one of those 1,400 TMDLs is going to result in a BMAP or a Basin Management Action Plan, it would cost us about $11.6 billion to comply with the laws governing the BMAP initiatives between now and 2040. So of this, typically about 53% of the cost ends up being a state responsibility. So that would produce a cost of $6.1 billion to the state of Florida to produce all of those BMAPs for all of those TMDLs. And this price is about 10% higher than last year's addition. The primary reasons being inflation is driving, pushing costs up some. But in addition, we've incorporated three additional BMAPs into our projections that we didn't have last year. So as an alternative, and this is something that DEP and EPA at the federal level are spending more time recognizing and talking about, we have something called alternative restoration plans. And alternative restoration plans can potentially avoid the need to develop a TMDL and avoid the need to go through the BMAP planning process and all the work associated with it and some of the monitoring needs. So it's generally speaking said to be more cost-effective and more cost-efficient than going all the way through the BMAP stage, but more importantly, quicker. It's a much quicker turnaround. And so since we've been working on this report, DEP has been increasingly vocal in their support of using these alternative restoration plans and using that as a much faster way to work through our impaired water bodies in Florida. So today we have, there's two types. One is what they call a 4B, and those are reasonable assurance plans. We have five of those in place. And then there's another one referred to as 4E plans. We have 135 water bodies that are 4E. That's about 18 more than the last report, which is more activity than we saw on the BMAPs, but still not a very rapid response yet. Unfortunately, for these alternative restoration plans, since they are somewhat new and how Florida is recommending them and using them, there is not any good data that's accessible to us at this time to do projections from. So we cannot tell you how much cheaper this is or how much more cost efficient this is until we can get that data available to us and can work through it. So that'll be for water quality. That's going to be our big initiative over the next year, is finding more data, more information, and more specifics about these alternative restoration plans to try to see if that would bring down the cost. In lieu of having that, our best number is this $11.6 billion, of which $6.1 billion is the state share. So that takes us into our next segment. This is, in terms of being able to report actual results, this is a brand new segment for us. In 2021, Speaker Renner was very engaged with other members to develop a new requirement for all our cities, counties, and special districts in Florida to produce different needs assessment for stormwater and wastewater needs. And so they were given, it's a 20-year needs assessment, so they were given a fair amount of time to work on that. We started getting our first reports this summer. We worked on a template. So the first thing we're going to talk about is the stormwater needs, because it's quite a bit different than wastewater. So we worked with a lot of stakeholders to create a template to use for their needs assessment. It has very detailed questions and specifics included in it, and we're just giving you kind of a snapshot of the highlights today. These numbers that I'm going to walk through were the ones that were actually reported to us. Our final analysis has not yet been released. It'll be released hopefully in the next week and a half. And in that analysis, it'll have a lot more breakdowns, including some projected costs for non-responsive entities. But what you're seeing today is based on the response to the legal requirement to submit these needs analyses. We've got 832 separate needs analyses for stormwater. And even though the majority of those needs analysis were submitted by independent special districts, about 526 of the 832, the vast majority of the storm management activities, and stormwater management activities and expenditures belong to the counties. We had about 50 of those, and to the municipalities, we had 256 plans for those. So the first thing that's worth noting about the stormwater needs analysis and through all of our discussion with the local entities that were involved in replying to this is that our stormwater goals within the state of Florida and with for each entity are not always super clear cut. There's multiple goals they're serving, sometimes on the same project or the same initiative, and or competing among different projects that they're deciding between. So those three are listed in table one on the left. So obviously drainage and flood abatement could be a very important goal, and it turns out it is the top goal, whether it's a county, municipality, or district. Water quality improvement is another important goal, and so we see a lot of activity in the BMAPs and the TMDLs that relate to stormwater. And then the third goal is a resiliency flooding goal to help reduce, control flooding, or to prepare as part of their resiliency plans. So depending on whether you're a county or a municipality, you tended to have a different response. The districts, because they were smaller in terms of what they were doing, and they generally have other responsibilities, so this ended up, stormwater ended up being their lesser goals, were dropping from the graph in figure one. And what it shows, it just shows you how they relatively compare. So local government, the big break, any way we looked at it, is between coastal counties and inland counties. They have completely different needs and views of what's happening with stormwater. So the coastal counties are much more likely to be concerned with climate-related vulnerability reduction and general flood control, where the inland counties seem to be much more focused on water quality. So that, and that distinction carries throughout. So we asked them quite a few questions, and we have a lot more detail available to us than we're showing here, but about what kinds of programs they have in place, what they do with those programs, what kind of tools do they have in place, what did they do with those. And once again, we saw that local governments and coastal counties were far more likely to have active programs in place and across all types of activities. They were more likely to be engaged. They were also more likely to report having an asset management system for their stormwater infrastructure, which is about 51% for coastal counties and about 44% for inland counties, just as one of the statistics. That's there's probably a lot of work that could be done here to help local governments prepare to manage their stormwater systems better. So there is some opportunities right at the front end for additional work that could be done. But we also asked them about their inventory, and I provided a chart that shows the main activities broken out by water management district. Overall, we have about 41,000 miles of buried culvert in Florida and about 65,000 miles of open ditches. When you look at how it breaks out, you can see from the red circles, the southern portion of the state, the South Florida Water Management District, and the Southwest Florida Water Management District are by far and away have the strongest presence in each of those items we're listing. In terms of expenditures, we've collapsed it here into a couple of broad categories. We actually have more detail available to us, but we asked them in five-year increments by types of projects what they anticipated spending on stormwater as we go forward over the course of their 20-year needs assessment. And so we also asked them to break it down between those that they already have a committed funding source identified for them and those projects where they do not have an identified funding source available to them. So the first chart is just looking at overall costs. And a couple of things stand out right away. If you look at the coastal, so for all three, for coastal and inland areas of the state, the flood protection is their number one most costly item that they have. But you can see there's a big difference between our coastal counties and our inland counties in terms of what that financial cost is to do flood water protection through stormwater expenditures. What is more interesting is the items that pop up as number two. So our choices were flood protection, water quality, end of useful life, and resiliency. And so for coastal areas of the state, the number two area of investment for them is on resiliency. And you can see that it's actually somewhat close to what they expect to be spending for flood protection. For our inland areas of the state, it's the water quality, and it's somewhat close, but both numbers are very low compared to the numbers you see in the coastal areas. Altogether, our costs for those projects over our 20-year needs assessment period is $27.4 billion. Of that $27.4 billion, about 71.2% of it is currently does not have an identified funding source associated with it. And then the remainder, it has a committed funding source already identified. So by far and away, the biggest chunk is things that they're still working on identifying how they would pay for it going forward. The number, $27.4 billion, is much higher than we were seeing in some of the national assessments that were being made, some of the federal documents that were available to us prior to the assessment. We have much, much greater confidence in these results than we had from some of the national projections. So we believe that this is true for those responding areas. It will grow if we do some numbers for non-responsive areas. So for stormwater segment, the needs least likely to have a known funding source, using those same four categories, if you look at the top graph, you're looking at coastal counties, and their area that they are least likely to have a known funding source for is their resiliency projects. And that's particularly true at the tails of the period initially and then moving into the end of the period. The second highest would be, and more in the early years than the later years, are flood protection. But for the inland counties, you can see that they're relatively, after we get through this first phase, they stay relatively close together and split among those different things. But their number one is flood protection. So moving on from stormwater to our wastewater needs analysis, it was crafted in the same law. So we did it in the same manner. We created a template for local governments to use to answer a number of questions about their wastewater programs. And so our submissions that we received for this, we received 276 separate needs analyses. The fewest came from independent special districts. There was 40. The majority came from municipalities, which were 200. But while only 36 needs analysis were submitted by counties, those counties directly provided wastewater services to over 40% of the population. So that's so pretty good coverage all in all. So in terms of wastewater activities, it can be measured on a number of different fronts. We gave you a few just for to give you a feel for what's in this area. So an important piece is lift stations. We have about 50,000 lift stations in Florida, which are typically used in conjunction with gravity mains to ensure wastewater flows towards the treatment facility. We've also given you some information on wastewater mains in Florida. We have about 74,000 miles across the state of wastewater mains. So, and again, kind of some differences in how those numbers break out. the relatively speaking, local governments in DEP Southwest District have more linear feet of wastewater mains than other areas of state, but local governments in the Southeast District report a much lower amount. So a lot of things go into this that we discuss more in our report, including local regulations, the age of local development, septic to sewer conversions, all kinds of things. So in terms of highlights from the report, there's a few things that we were particularly interested to look at. One was what we called green infrastructure best management practices, which was a suite of activities. So it could be lining, it could be cogeneration, it could be reuse of reclaimed water, it could be hydrogen sulfide recovery or use and beneficial use of biosolids. So when we queried the local governments and got their results back in their needs analysis, 86, the first thing to bear in mind is of the 276, 86 belong to utilities that only collect wastewater, and 52 belong to utilities that treat wastewater collected by other utilities. So all utilities are not the same, and they have different purposes. Our local governments reported operating about 370 wastewater treatment facilities with about 10 additional under construction. So in looking at how they deploy their green infrastructure best management practices, most of them currently engage in or plan or continue to engage in lining their existing wastewater mains, which is much faster and less expensive than replacement, and less disruption occurs more easily. But additionally, 64.5% of the respondents reported they currently reuse reclaimed water. And a number of 21 local governments reported that even though they do not use reclaimed water now, they plan to do so in the future. And then we had 5 for various reasons that reported that they plan to stop engaging in the practice. And so you can see all of those statistics below from each of our green infrastructure best management practices. So moving to expenditures. So this was developed in exactly the same way. We asked them to report their expenditures in 5-year increments by project. So it's very detailed behind what you see here today. We got the project type, the subtype, and whether or not, once again, it had a committed funding source or no identified funding source. And we broke the project types most broadly up at effluent management, water quality, resiliency, reuse development, end of useful life replacement, and septic to sewer conversion. And so you can see the results once again split between the coastal areas of the state and the inland areas of the state in terms of magnitude and somewhat on results. For both areas, unlike what we saw in stormwater, for both areas, end of useful life replacement was their number one projected expenditure going forward. And then secondarily to that, they split. So if you look at the coastal areas of the state, effluent management is their second most large expenditure. For inland areas, it was water quality. And then you have the total for both segments. Altogether, it was $62.5 billion worth of projected investments needed in the future. To that, in the bottom, we added one additional piece to it, which is the customer piece associated with septic to sewer. So that brought our total up to $63.3 billion, inclusive of those customers. And what you can see is they're pretty, once you make that conversion, they're pretty equally split between committed funding sources and no identified sources. So the numbers are not that different, but they're both large numbers, so the no identified funding source here is $29.9 billion. Wastewater, it's probably worth saying here that wastewater and stormwater has some really unique features between them. Wastewater typically has customers that can be billed. Costs could increase on those customers to identify different things going forward. That is not a feature for stormwater. So it doesn't quite mean exactly the same thing to say that you have no identified funding source for wastewater expenditures as it does for stormwater expenditures. Once again, that $29.9 billion was much higher than any number we had seen. Well, you could either do the $29.9 billion or the grand total of over $60 billion were higher than the numbers we were seeing in some of those old national report cards. So again, just looking at which wastewater needs are least likely to have known funding sources, coastal counties definitely stood out, and there's a piece of it that was somewhat surprising to me, which was the end of useful life replacement. So that is, there's a couple of very large projects that cause it to spike like that don't yet have identified funding for them, but that it's clearly stands out among everything else on the list. Secondarily, the sewer conversion is pretty high and stays flat all the way through as being something that currently doesn't have identified funding source. Inland counties were pretty much split across all of the six areas that we had in our report, and nothing really spiked significantly for the inland counties. Okay, moving on to our next segment, which is flooding and sea level rise. This is the newest portion of what we're including in our analyses. It has been with us the least amount of time. Our law here is a little bit different than what our charge was in some of the other areas. So here, we're supposed to look at ultimately a 50-year planning horizon, and we're supposed to develop what's the best way to achieve the legislature's intent of minimizing the adverse economic effects of inland and coastal flooding, thereby decreasing the likelihood of severe dislocations or disruptions in the economy and preserving the value of real and natural assets to extent economically feasible. So a piece of this is going to be trying to develop costs associated with likely resilience steps that will be taken by local governments. So that is, in that sense, it's a little bit like what we're doing in water quality, where we're trying, and water supply demand, where we're trying to identify what's the most likely path forward for local governments to take. So this is a multi-year process, and we're very early in the process. So the first thing that we were doing last year was just providing the literature review, different sources of information, and what we were looking at overall. This year, we're moving into creating what we're calling at-risk assessment areas. And right now we have three. We have a high impact zone, an intermediate impact zone, and a dispersed impact zone. Ultimately, we'll be dividing the entire state into those three zones. But this year we focused on the high impact zone, and we defined it as the 35 coastal counties which are most at risk. So going forward, we'll be relaxing that assumption, but that's how we define it for this report. I provided an assessment map here, which is really just showing you what kinds of things we think about as we're trying to identify the at-risk areas and what kind of resiliency projects they would need. So this year we focused on storm surge, we focused on flooding, and we focused on a sea level rise of 2 feet as the basis of our analysis. And then within the high impact zone, we also looked at what kind of critical facilities we had in there and what's the property types and values that we have in that high impact zone. So this first chart lists out the 35 counties. It tells you what the property value, the just value, for those of you that spend a lot of time with the ad valorem tax roll, it tells you what the just value were for those counties for a segment of their properties. We excluded vacant lands, so we only focused on lands that had been developed. And then we did different analyses to try to identify what areas of risk the county was under. And clearly, the highest area of risk to the state, both in terms of its property value and in terms of the threats that it faced, is Miami-Dade County. Our second highest was Palm Beach County. Our third highest was Broward County. If you use all 35 counties, we have about $3.1 trillion in property value in those counties that's non-vacant. The other thing we analyze, it's what's happening with its economy. We do this as a share of the state's GDP. So for the same 35 counties, we ranked them, looked at them, and provided what their percentage of the state's GDP is. So, you know, considering all of the areas together are about 77.35%. of the state's GDP in those coastal counties that are at risk. And if you look at everything together, you still come up with the southeast portion of the state as being the most vulnerable, including Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade. And if you bring in Monroe County, that's a third of the state's GDP at flooding risk. So the other thing we did, and this is probably not going to be easy for you to see up here, but I'll walk through what you have. The first, we did an infrastructure assessment at the 2-foot sea level rise scenario, actually looking at where our schools in the state are located, our medical facilities are located, and our fire stations. And if you just kind of eyeball it, you can tell our fire stations are particularly vulnerable along the coastal areas of Florida. It's followed by schools and then medical facilities, but some of these medical facilities are very large and they're regional, so they're not really on the same footing. We also did the same analysis looking at a storm surge associated with a Hurricane Cat 5 and those same clusters of facilities, fire stations, schools, and medical facilities. And again, you can see fire stations are very high risk because of their location in these counties, then schools and medical facilities as well. Our third analysis that we did, and this is probably the hardest to see, is the same three critical infrastructure facilities, but looking at flood zones and which ones were located in the flood zones. So when we bring all of that together, and we have lots more maps and analyses on our website, this year's effort here is mostly focused on identifying that high impact zone. A couple of things do start to come out. So the actual number of structures located in these different high-impact areas is not necessarily the most important thing. What you can see is because of the low-lying areas, in a number of cases, it's going to be accessibility if there's submergence of transportation routes. So we're starting to get a more nuanced picture of what's at risk. What's also clear is the state may start to consider, which which people have been talking about already, relocating some of the existing at-risk facilities, building future facilities further from the hazard areas. But because of those connecting route issues, transportation issues, we may also want to start developing alternative means of providing those critical services. So is there another mechanism in a very high-risk area of providing fire services than the traditional hook and ladder truck? You know, is helicopter drops of water something we can explore? Are there other things we can explore? Are there barges that we can use to transport water to for fire, put out fires in some areas? So regardless, we probably want to start thinking about some alternative means and starting to invest in those for providing critical services. And going forward on this, so this year we developed a high impact zone using a countywide, but we have now populated with data that we can start to flex the high impact zone based on where we're seeing the greatest areas of risk, so that's less than countywide, or in some cases goes into an inland county. So over the next year, beginning already, our work is going to be trying to fine tune that high impact zone and then recalculating the inventory of what's in that high impact zone. We're also going to be developing the first stage of the intermediate impact zone next year and also doing the inventory of property in there. And then finally, we're going to be starting to pull in local resiliency plans where they exist and they're, what they're planning to do going forward, and trying to embed some of that information in as well. We've also been reaching out to a couple of federal agencies, trying to enter into some data sharing partnerships with them to kind of leverage some of the resources that are available to us. So hopefully we'll have something to report on that next year as well. So Mr. Chairman, this concludes everything we have this year. The only thing that's not addressed here is sometime in the next week, we'll probably be putting out the Everglades report. We're working with South Florida Water Management District on that.
Mrs. Baker, thank you. A very complex, thorough report. I know that members, if you hadn't strapped on your seatbelts today, you understood that we would be digging very deep, as you saw. And I would encourage you to make sure you take this report and run through it, ask questions, because there's so much complexity here that we can't absorb it all in a 45-minute window. So take the report and look at it. If you have time, we have about just under 30 minutes before we finish, and I wouldn't put you on the spot for the full 30 minutes because you've been at the dais for a while. But I want to give the members an opportunity to ask questions. So members, let's go to questions, and Representative Honchowski, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for this report. It's a little overwhelming, but very necessary, and I love the idea and the fact that we're really looking at what does the future look like and what do we need to have a solid future going forward. One of my questions is just very process, I guess, oriented. When I went to your website with the annual assessments of Florida water resources and conservation lands, I saw that in the 2021 edition and prior, it was all consolidated into one report and included gap analyses. There was even mention that different departments might actually have overlap in some of the lands that they were looking at, and it was all done And then I noticed in 2022 and 2023, it got split up a little bit more. And I just wanted to ask, is there a reason for that? Is it going to then be all brought together? Or what is the reason for that? And will we see more of a comprehensive, including the gap analysis going forward?
You're recognized.
I think we're up to over 500 pages on our website. So it's it was too big to put it all in one document, which is what we did before. But the components will be there. So everything that we talked about today has already been posted. We're posting them as individual chapters. But everything we've talked about except stormwater and wastewater has already been released. Stormwater and wastewater probably in the next week and a half, and Everglades hopefully in the next week. We're also going to provide some historic funding information that for what Florida's done in the past on water supply and water quality. So that chapter will be released. And then when we finish, I hope to do an executive summary that talks about everything. In terms of the land acquisition, that is still true. Part of our effort, the individual lists developed by different state agencies do have significant areas of duplication among them. So that's one of the things we have to do to come to our total is dedupe it. Try to figure out, okay, if it's two agencies going after the same parcel, we're only going to count it once.
Follow up? Other questions? Representative.
Thank you, Chair. I've got a question about the conservation slides, and I'm just curious. I think you said it would take 746 years or 764 years. So obviously that's not realistic because I assume some of that land will be occupied, and you were talking about some of it is getting close to that. What are the steps that we can take in the interim to ensure that that land is not purchased, or are there any steps that we can take to get us closer to finding the money? Like, what's a solution, I suppose, is what I'm asking.
I think there's a couple of things. So one is, so the agencies every year diligently produce their lists, and then they update it, and then the next year they update it again. So it's perhaps, as a policy decision, it's making some decisions on what our pace of land acquisition is going to be, what we're going to try to commit to, or additional guidance to the state agencies on what lands we want them to look at, maybe tighten that up some so that we don't just have a giant list that keeps growing over time. So maybe additional direction on what we want on these lists. Where do we want to invest? What land is most valuable to us? And then trying to cost that out, which we could, and then a time frame in which we want to purchase it. So there could be more planning that's done in that area to tighten up what is right now just multiple lists.
Follow-up, Representative Gottlieb.
So just a brief follow-up to that. What can we as a legislature do? Because what I'm hearing you saying is we can task these other agencies, so on and so forth. But what can we do, you know, in this committee perhaps in terms of legislation or do we have the ability to mandate that land as conservation land moving forward? You know, what are some solutions that you can suggest that we could follow?
You're recognized.
I think you can always provide policy direction in the law to the agencies and to the water management districts. But in addition to that, we could do some things like look at why it takes so long to move from the appropriation of dollars for parcels and the actual acquisition of parcels. So that would bring it forward. If we could identify a way to shorten that process, it would bring some of that acquisition forward. So that DEP would more likely be able to answer exactly where they're seeing the lags. There has to be a willing buyers. Yeah, I mean, a willing seller who's willing to give up their land or particular uses of their land for conservation purposes, that's a long process. But there may be other pieces that we could speed up in that. So that would be something DEP could provide some suggestions on.
Representative Fabricio, do you have a question? No, you're good. So that brings me to Representative Escalante.
Thank you so much, Chair. It feels just like Ways and Means.
Sure does.
Hi, Ms. Baker. Longtime fan, first time asking questions. So great to formally have this chance. So I have a few questions, but I'll go through the chair. I noticed in the report when it comes to local governments that do reclamation that five said they were going to be stopping that practice. Qualitatively speaking, what were their reasons for stopping?
I'm going to let Kate Beggs come up and answer that question. She is actually our expert analyst over the stormwater wastewater responses, and she looked at each of those.
Yes, we we don't actually have the reasons. It was just a yes-no question.
Uh-huh. Okay.
However, I have spoken to a local government a municipality that used to have a purple pipe system. They used to have a reuse distribution network, and they chose to stop that mainly because of the cost.
Okay.
And so instead, they switched to an aquifer recharge project. So it's much more concentrated. There's less upkeep. There's less just day-to-day problems they have to deal with their aquifer recharge.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you for that. Chair, may I do a follow-up?
Certainly.
Thank you.
And we will need an appearance card for her, if you don't mind. So we appreciate that. So
absolutely.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Chair. For the lift station, I first just want to say thank you. I like the breakdown between utility and private, so that's a good breakdown to have. Do we ever track how often a lift station fails, and is that a local or a private failure? And I just speak from experience in my district because we have these issues sometimes, especially with the fast growth, and the private lift stations don't always function the way they need to. And so I'm curious, do we track failure of that and how much sewage is spilled when they do fail in those moments?
We haven't done anything with that directly because really our first efforts here have been analyzing the needs assessment. So there wasn't really an opportunity in that document for them to talk about major failures or problems that they've been experiencing. It was more quantitative than that. But it's something, Kate, do you have anything you can add on that?
I believe the DEP does track sanitary sewer overflows. Whether or not an overflow, like in their database with their tracking system, whether it, they have like a, is this due to a lift station failure? We don't know.
Okay. Or
they would definitely know, but I don't.
Okay, thank you for that. And then Chair, I think I just have maybe one or two.
Yeah, let me just follow up on that. I think that most often that's a self-reporting requirement, and DEP would follow up on it. So from what I understand, so don't quote me on that, but it's what I've seen locally. So.
Awesome. And you recognize. Yeah, I appreciate that. I just wasn't curious if EDR collected that data. I know it is collected, but wasn't sure if it was in analysis to, you know, see a breakdown. But I can definitely, you know, follow with DEP too. Okay, so pivoting a little bit, you know, when it comes to sea level rise and the current risk assessment, is there any indication based on the data? I know we're talking about government construction and government buildings and emergency response systems, but how about just private development? Because there's been a larger conversation, especially the impact in Southwest Florida, that is it smart to rebuild in the same way, knowing the changes that our planet and our state is going through? So is there an expectation for the final report to also include recommendations when it comes to future construction across our state?
You're recognized.
In this analysis, I'm not sure we have enough to do that. We have the inventory, including private. Mm-hmm. That's where the $3.1 trillion came from. But in terms of what do we do about the as the best solutions in that area, I think that's part of the work that we really have planned for next year. So I don't think, there's definitely nothing in the report that we have online, and I don't think we have anything ready to go on that yet.
Okay. And then one last question, Chair, if I may.
One last question.
Fabulous. To water consumption. I'm just curious, does our data in your presentation today or the greater reports that we have, is it residential? Is it commercial? Are we also considering, like, you know, companies that come in to pump water, whether it's for their business or if they're a water bottling company for their practice itself, are we keeping that data, and are we assuming that that type of consumption permit expires at a certain time or is renewed? Like, how do we calculate some of these private practices that, you know, are kind of not necessarily pre-planned, but kind of get approval and then begin?
Recognized.
We mostly quantify what is in the water management district report. So they're using every type of use, whether it's golf course or in some water management districts, they look at seasonal residents, they look at, you know, commercial, industrial. So they're projecting out at a very finite level, and they are taking their consumptive use permits into account in some of their numbers. So I would say we do not have anything in-house that would provide exactly for each water management district what its specific assumptions were, but it is there in the data because overall they're covering it.
Great. Members, other questions? Okay, seeing no other questions, Mrs. Baker, you and your staff, thank you so much for being here. Phenomenal job. Y'all take a crystal ball that's fuzzy and somehow another find clarity. It still amazes me, but thank you for your presentation today. Thank you so much. We do have, I'm going to allow one appearance card today. We do have an appearance card from Chris Doolin. Chris, you're recognized for a short, I'd like to speak for a few comments.
Thank you, sir. My name is Chris Doolin. I work with the Small County Coalition. And I have to say how fortunate we are to have Amy Baker and EDR, her resources available, and their website is fantastic. And for the newbies, it's very, very informative. We absolutely support a comprehensive program that begins to pull together all the issues that we deal with as it relates to water. Septic to sewer, springs protection, you know what they are. Stormwater, wastewater. To be able to identify all that, and this report and their work will go a long way, and the speaker is absolutely, I think, committed to coming up with a long-range plan to address
100%.
It.
100%, yeah.
Every year you spend almost $1 billion. Water management districts, Department of Agriculture, DEP, and your water projects. Wouldn't it be a more better way to put it into a system of like the state road plan where you got a 5-year work plan that you can identify the priorities? We will be particularly concerned about the ability to pay our small counties and the fiscally constrained and those larger counties that have the page 3 of the report, how much percentage is off the tax roll, and so it's going to be very complicated, but we couldn't have a better chairman than Bobby Payne. You absolutely are the best. I mean, it's a good group. So
I'll give you those $20 later.
Sir?
I'll give you those $20 later.
So. Okay. Did you? Okay.
Sorry. Couldn't help myself.
So anyway, we'll look forward to working with you. We know we have folks here that share the concern and the ability to pay. You guys have taken care of our fiscally constrained, and you're, I think with the cost of some of these projects, there will need to be some priorities established so that we can also do some of those things. But this is not just a rural issue. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Doolin. Appreciate your comments. Yep. Members, that concludes our meeting for today. And seeing no other questions, Representative Kittlebrew, who's going to answer all of our questions in the next meeting, moves that we rise. And with that, we're adjourned.